Hello there. After 100 episodes of this podcast, we've decided to set up a Patreon account whereby listeners can donate us money to help pay for our hosting costs. If you like what we do and fancy tossing a few groats our way, please head over to our website at creightoncrowbar.com for more details. And now, back to the show. Hello and welcome to episode 101 of the Crate and Crowbar podcast, a PC gaming podcast. I'm Marsh Davis, and I'm talking to you on the 14th of July. I'm joined this evening by Graham Smith.
Hello.
Chris Thurston.
Good evening.
And Tom Senior.
Good evening also.
And due to our incompetence in not being able to find any cool news to talk about, we've instead got a cool take.
A very cold take. Crate and Crowbar cold takes coming hot and fresh. Cold and fresh. Top of Tom Senior. Today, I only just realised, even though this was announced months ago, that Rainbow Six Siege is getting Terrorist Hunt mode, which is a dedicated co-op mode, which is you versus AI, which is also one of the fucking best bits of the old Rainbow Six Vegas games, but not the old Rainbow Six games, which were unplayable by today's standards. Vegas and New Vegas. No, Vegas and Vegas 2.
New Vegas.
Yeah. New Vegas. Yes.
No, that was a Fallout. That was a Fallout
so
game.
So confused. The point is that mode was great, and I'm far more interested in the co-op versus AI stuff than the frantic, competitive stuff that they led with Rainbow Six Siege.
Really, I really like that.
I like the idea of it, but like when I was playing in the alpha, it just felt too insane and fast and frenzied and frenetic to me. Whereas what was really fun about Terrorist Hunt in the old Vegas games was that it was surprisingly methodical. There was a lot of space in the level, and there was a lot of opportunity to set up rappel points and actually plan an attack, and then execute it with your friends, and then improvise when things went wrong. Whereas I think the maps in Siege that I've seen so far look really much, much, much smaller than, like, I can't remember, I think it was Murder House or Murder Town or something, was one of the biggest maps in Vegas, which was actually quite significant size. And you could traverse the rooftops, and there were many ways into all the buildings. And terrorists would seemingly randomly spawn across the map, and then it became this interesting dynamic challenge. And I find that much more interesting, but I do worry a little bit that it's too cramped and difficult and almost too realistic. I was reading about the Iranian embassy siege today after looking at Rainbow Six stuff, and it's just a catalogue of total carnage. Like, the first thing that happens is a man rappels down, I think it was their staff sergeant, and he gets caught in the rappel rope, and therefore he can't throw in the flashbang and stuff, the explosion that he wants to actually breach and clear into the building. Then when they do eventually get the stun grenade into the room, it sets fire to the curtains, which then horrendously burns the staff sergeant, who's still dangling above the window. And that's how the Iranian siege started. That's how the 17-minute SAS attack that resolved that situation started, with that kind of calamitous act. And then they burst in.
Don't think that's going to be possible when
I'm saying that that's not desirable.
Right.
I'm saying that the kind of carnage and, you know, everything's full of smoke, and they do something called, I can't remember what it's called, I think it's point shooting, where it's about instinctive shooting, where you don't even use iron sights. So in close quarters, you just point and shoot the gun, and that's actually a far more efficient way of killing enemies in close quarters. So a lot of tactical squads like the SAS and Israeli forces use that and train it into its complete instinct to point and shoot and get really good at that. And it feels as though that's what Siege is going for, where it's this totally, like, there's noise everywhere and there's constantly stuff happening, and you can't really quite parse it all, and you can't really, like, organise too much beyond the start. You can organise in the planning phase, of course, that's what that's for. But there's no kind of methodical room for you to plan with your friends once the starting gun is fired. Whereas what I loved about the Vegas games and Terrorist Hunt was that it allowed for that all the time. And that's what was really fun about co-op and really, really enjoyed about the game.
See, I wonder if the small maps are an antidote to that chaos. Like I used to be part of our Counter-Strike clan, and we would specialise in playing the diffuse map Prodigy. And one of the things you would do is come up with different plans for different eventualities based on where you thought the terrorist or the counter-terrorist you were fighting against were approaching. And I think that Siege is set up in the competitive mode for that kind of clan play, where they're hoping that people will spend time beforehand getting to know all the different classes with their various abilities and putting together their favourite teams, and then learning the maps to such a degree that it is about getting that information about what your enemy's attempting and then going, oh, they're on the roof, or oh, they're rappelling down, or oh, they're approaching through the garage, that sort of stuff. And you've set up your wall defences and that kind of thing in such a way that you can quickly adapt it to the information that you've now got and that sort of thing. Mm. I think you're probably right that it doesn't work so well in public servers. In like the closed beta, there was no way to join matches with your friends. Yeah. Like there was no lobby system or anything like that. And I suspect that's just going to be pretty chaotic. But I think it lends itself really well to clan-based play. Whether that would be any use to us or whether it's a greater degree more than that. Yeah, I agree with you, to be honest. I'm more looking forward to Terrorist Hunt as well, because I always prefer playing against AI, and that mod was fucking great.
Yeah.
There's a lot of precedent for complex team games, competitive games that seem like complete chaos when you start playing them, but as soon as you pass, you start to understand them, but you start to get better at them, they actually become simpler, strangely, or the vocabulary or the verb set becomes a little bit narrower because you learn what the correct actions are. So rather than all of the players doing all of the things, you learn on the three things you need to do in the level, and so maybe it simplifies in that way.
It's interesting because the Counter-Strike thing is that there's always like two or three alleys or kind of routes that you could just look at the map and know where they are. The top-down map that you see at the start, you could just know where the entry points are. Whereas Siege is about destructibility, and then you get the option to reinforce almost any panel of wall around you, and almost any panel of wall around you, and indeed ceiling or floor above or below you, are also destructible. So it feels like those routes are... There are no routes. Like, maybe that's not true once you actually get used to the maps. Maybe there are just things that everyone will always attempt because anything else is stupid. But it feels as though going into that, it's like, what do you do? Like, what do you just kind of improvise and guess?
It feels like you're setting up mobile choke points, almost. Mm. Like, you are choosing to reinforce certain walls in order to funnel your enemy down a certain path that you then put barbed wire on or set up encampments with your iron sights pointed at it, that sort of stuff. But like all the trailers they're putting out at the moment are like introducing the SAS team and the GIGN, the French team, and that sort of stuff. And each of the different classes has a different tool, which is their thing. And so I suspect that's what it will be. It'll be you're Kevlar guy. Your job is that you hand out Kevlar. And that's one of the classes. Or you're the guy with the gun that fires a stim pack that heals people, and I think it's set up that you'll base your strategies around that of like, we've got the guy that does this makes it useful in this particular way, therefore we will place our walls such to try and manipulate the enemy into doing the thing that we want them to.
Does that not dent the fantasy a bit, the kind of, you know, like the MOBA thing of having everyone be good at one thing? Is a part of the fantasy, this kind of counter-terrorist operation that you sort of, it's quite lean, you know what I mean? It's like people have special powers. Like the guy from the Iranian embassy, his special power wasn't dangling inside of curtains.
That guy is certainly, he was a separate rappel team had to cut him down as he was obviously jumping away from the building on his rappel rope while still on fire. And they had to cut him at the point where he was still swinging back in so that he would land on the balcony. At which point he landed, got up and stormed the building with second-degree burns of his legs just went in there. I would hate to go through the training that let me become that person to become the Kevlar guy who just like sets on fire, just sits down, opens a bag and gives everyone Kevlar.
Kevlar vest man. Well, first of all, it seems like he should have done his job before the mission began. So that's not maybe not so great.
Oh god, we need the bulletproof vests. Who's got the bag?
But I think that's kind of part of the fantasy, because it's asymmetric and one team is setting up defences and one team is trying to breach and clear. It almost feels like you're putting together a heist team. And so I can believe people getting really into the fantasy of, I am the guy with the really big shield, I go in first and protect my friends kind of thing, and just getting the satisfaction of being really good at that and feeling useful because you're really good at that.
Tom, did you watch the footage of Terrorist Hunt at E3? The Ubisoft stage?
A little bit of it, but I don't think I've seen all of it yet. Because I apparently only noticed today, so.
Because that revolved around like storming a room and then like setting up like a bomb disarming laptop. You know, those. And, and then defending it against like a rush that came in. And so they like, they sort of, it was sort of like an attack then defend against AI. I don't know if that's going to be universally the format for Terrace Hunt, but so the idea was that you could have, you went in, did the clearing with your little little roly adorable drone thing, and and then you like they said like shore up that one. It was always, it was one of those things that only Ubisoft do where they have like almost like pretend bants. But it was a live demo, but obviously they kind of knew roughly what they were going to do.
You know, the reason that those kind of presentations are so hokey on stage is because there's like a 3 to 10 second delay on everything they do.
Huh. Is that delay so that if they swear, they can beep it?
No, it's just a you know, a side effect of the fact that it's just, you know, a complex thing to display at large
sizes. Right. Fair enough. Interesting. But yeah, that seemed to like the knock out that wall so we got line of sight through it, and then fortify that wall and crouch there and shoot that man and so on. So it seemed like reactive rather than like, here is a room, here is how we crack the room, at least 50% of the time.
Huh. Interesting. I'm kind of want to be excited about it, but still have some reservations about it, I think.
I really want, this year, I was actually about to say, I really want the Breach and Clear game, or the, you know, there's the tactical ops game, which has like, you know, Gang Beast style slapstick, but, you know, where you can dangle upside down and accidentally set yourself on fire. But that is Intruder, pretty much. You can fall the fuck over in that game, which is a really important part of being, you know, having those actions physically simulated.
Yeah, yeah.
Intruder is fundamentally a game about two teams of people, one guards, one intruders, neither of whom have received any training whatsoever.
That would be a good team feature.
Yeah, that would be actually. Interestingly, we tried to jump into it the other day to play it. I'm the only people online at the time that we chose to play it. And it is still great, but if there's ever a game that has desperately, desperately needed private servers, it's that one. Like, at the moment, you can functionally get a private server because there's multiple servers up and the player base is low enough that you can get one. But it's a game that is absolutely born for, like, 2v2 or 3v3 with just your mates, or even trying something weird, like 1v4, and you play it as, like, Splinter Cell, but where all the characters are real people.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't do that currently. Yeah. And of course, there's some other issues as well. Like, I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but, like, I know Pip finds it quite uncomfortable, because it's a game that's all about your voice and about the fact that when you talk, you can actually be heard in a radius around your character in the game. And, it's this diegetic representation of voice in the game.
Does she try and put in a Batman voice to disguise her agenda?
Yeah, and it is just that. I mean, it's not...
Hi, Pip!
She sounds like that all the time. Oh, yeah. But that's, you know, that... That's another good reason for that game to have private service. I don't know. I want the developers to pick up on that message and allow me to play Intruder, but only with people I like.
Yeah. What have you been playing, Chris?
What I've also been playing with people I like, actually, is the best game that's been released so far of all the games, at the moment at least, which is Rocket League, or Rocket Cars, as it should probably be called, or Car Football, or Rocket Car Football, or... Yeah, basically, and this is the game that's at the top of the Steam charts at the moment, and everybody's talking about it. And I think it kind of arrived out of nowhere. It's basically a remake slash update for a game that came off the PS3, which had a really long, complicated name, like something like it was like, you know, Super Rocket Powered Battle Cars, something, something, something. A couple of years ago, it was apparently quite popular, and this is the first time I think it's been available on PC. And suddenly it's the top of the Steam charts and everybody's talking about it. But basically what it is it's football with cars. And that's what it is. But you control little buggies that can boost and jump. And kind of double jump, but it's not really a double jump. It's more like the first jump makes you leap, and then the second jump, based on which way you're turning, boosts your car in that direction. So you can flip sideways either direction, forwards, backwards, and if you boost with that judging a direction, you go straight up again. So it's sort of like a directional flip, basically. And you combine that with boosting around to try and punt a giant floaty ball into a goal at the other end of the pitch. And there are no weapons at all, and all the cars are identical. There's no classes or anything like that. You can heavily customize your car with cosmetic stuff, but everyone's functionally equal, and the game is mega, mega, mega simple. There is one mode, and it's get ball into goal.
What does your car look like, Chris?
My car... I've gone through several iterations because you unlock stuff. Actually, that's really, and this is the least interesting thing about it, but one of the ways it works is you get an unlock after every game you play. And rather than the unlocks being sorted by rarity or something like that, you just get one every time from the whole pool. And so everyone gets stuff in a different order, which I think is quite clever because it means that within 5 games, all of your mates look different because one of you's gotten a new chassis and one of you's gotten a new flag for the back of the car. whatever. And you you become idiosyncratic very quickly, which is quite sweet, because, you know, one of you's driving around like the mystery machine from Scooby-Doo with a wizard hat on trailing rainbows. My car, is, some sort of, like, it looks like it probably owns a steak restaurant. Right. It wears, like, a mariachi hat. It has a horseshoe antenna with a big, like, Texas Lone Star on the front, and it shits a yellow laser when I when I boost. That's only the current car. If I ever get the wizard hat, I'm going to switch over to that. I got a top hat, which was the first hat I got, and someone immediately spoiled it for me by pointing out my car looked like Total Biscuit. Anyway, the thing you do in the game, so it's dead simple, and like, it's just a game about zipping around these very nippy little cars and trying to punt a ball into a goal. And it's kind of all soft edges. Like, one of the reasons I think it's brilliant is the arena has like curved edges, and it goes up onto the walls, and you can drive up onto the walls if you're going fast enough, and almost up onto the ceiling. And almost everything you can crash into doesn't stop your momentum. The ball, you kick the ball, you lose some momentum, but you crash into the wall, and you just go up the wall. And you're constantly tumbling around and flipping over. It's all physics-based. Crashing into other players can stop you, or blow them up, or blow you up. And crashing into the edge of the goal sometimes can slow you down, but the rest of the time, there's this sort of constant sense of kind of, like, slapstick fluidity in motion. And when you start playing, just getting the car to the ball and hitting the ball in a way that vaguely resembles what you want to do is an achievement. So goals happen arbitrarily. People score own goals all the time. People, everyone's constantly kind of just sort of flailing around, flipping over, crashing into things, falling over, trying to rocket boost into the air. You can pick up like boosters, and if you fill up your boost bar, you can kind of rocket enough to get all the way into the air, to kind of almost fly around for a bit. And it's hilarious, because it does a really good job of showcasing moments of terribleness and brilliance, where every time a goal is scored, it gives everybody this gigantic replay that's really fun to watch, of like the moment the sort of the touch was made that resulted in the goal being scored. And sometimes it's a disastrous own goal, and everyone has to sit there and watch it as it happens. But then as you play it, you realize that it has this huge skill ceiling, and the best players in the world are genuinely amazing at it. And you realize you can do bicycle kicks in a car. So you can, like, drive under the ball, jump, and then flip backwards and, like, kick it backwards over your head. And you see people do these, like, dazzling flying saves, or, like, rocket into the air and then, like, scissor kick, if you can say a car does that. The ball sideways off another car and into the goal, or, you know, these kind of amazing things. The tactics kind of emerge about whether you rush the ball at the start or whether you stay back. And it becomes really competitive, but it's a rare example of a multiplayer game that scales brilliantly from just like a knockabout to taking it seriously. Like, there are already tournaments, people winning money within the week of the game's release, because it supports that and it's brilliant to watch. But I played a Dota tournament this weekend, and between every game we would just play Rocket League, because it's super flexible. And unlike, I think, a lot of like the really great multiplayer games, because there's been a lot of them in the last couple of years, from Towerfall or Gang Beasts or Nidhogg or Samurai Gun, above all of those games, it has exactly the feature set you need to support engaging with it in any of those ways. So you can set it up for 2v2, 3v3, or 4v4, and there is full bot support for all of those modes, and it can be dynamic with the bot supports as well. So if one of your friends drops out, it instantly replaces them with a bot within a second. And it means that you can just keep playing and playing and playing, which you'll want to do because it's great. And you can add friends in and take friends out, and people can kind of drop in and drop out of sort of these sort of like rolling sessions. You can sort of set the teams to random, so everybody's matched with different people every time. And it's sort of somewhere between like a party game, a game that you can legitimately play by yourself with randoms on servers, and it's really fun because it has it's a high skill ceiling acrobatic multiplayer. Kind of a combat game in that it's about, you know, contesting for the ball, but there's no weaponry, so it feels super organic and less punishing than it might do if there were rocket launchers or something in it.
It's just nice to have a really high skill ceiling competitive game that doesn't involve shooting men in the face, really.
Yeah. Loads of tribes comparisons being made, actually, because it has that kind of thing. But it's like Tribes by Guns, basically. It's like Tribes if the goal was to get the flag and get it back, and you could kick the flag out of people's hands.
With a car.
I've played it a bit. I think it solves a lot of the problems that football games have, in that
they're boring.
I like
not about cars.
being a car is a much easier thing to control and much more understandable in a video game context than having a human body. Because the way that football games choose to abstract the human motions that turn into a shot is to just say, press B and your guy will just kind of figure it out. They'll just kind of, you'll kind of get some aim over it, but you lose control at the point where you press shoot in FIFA. The massively complex algorithm that makes that player move in a realistic and believable way actually takes all that control off you. Whereas playing as a cuboid that you can manipulate in midair and tilt actually gives you all that control back and gives you all that skill back. And it gives you all that kind of improvisational kind of moment of skill and genius that you just don't really get in football games anymore. Like, you can pull off a bicycle kick, but it's all about the kind of algorithmic context of where the ball is and where your player is and how close defenders are to you in a FIFA. Whereas that's the thing, you could just, you have total control of your movements. And because analog sticks are just brilliant at rotating and you can understand and get a feel for the weight of your rotation, it actually gives you control of your body. And it was necessary to simplify your body to make that work. So I think that actually Rocket League has something that football games will never have, because it will never be able to let you kick a ball, you know?
It's interesting, football is like, I was going to say, it's obviously football because the rule set is pretty much, well, it doesn't have the rules of football in terms of like fouls and stuff, or the offside rule, which would ruin it. But it's, you know, it's a ball and it starts in the centre and you've got to kick it into a goal at either end. But really it's a lot of other sports as well. And I think there's a sort of strong volleyball aspect to it. Because of the kind of kinetic, because of just the way the ball moves, it doesn't really move like a football. It's almost never scooting along the ground. It's almost always up in the air, with a lot of people like reversing, looking up, trying to get under it. There's a great GIF on the an illustrative GIF on the Rocket League subreddit, which is of a blind dog trying to anticipate where a ball is going to land that it can probably hear or smell, and getting it completely fucking wrong. And that is Rocket League. Like, that is the, the other reason for that is that because you're a car, cars accelerate very quickly and turn quite slowly. And so in terms of getting from one end of the pitch to the other, it doesn't take very much time. You're not in a football situation where it's actually a jog to get from one end of the to the pitch to the other. And that makes it feel a bit more like ice hockey, volleyball, even something like tennis, where the space, your defensive space on your side of it is something you can cross pretty quickly. You can still be caught out at the wrong side of it, but there's a lot of birds, just a lot of little tweety birds. but you've got a lot of, you can reposition really quickly and move around quickly, and what that allows you to do is transition between positions really quickly. So while there's absolutely playing defense in it and playing offense, there's a fluidity to it that comes with just it feeling a little bit smaller. And I think that allows it to be the rare example of a football game where every player is one character, whereas normally you have to kind of control a team or half a team, depending on how you're playing FIFA or something. Because otherwise, I don't think anyone's ever made it fun to just stand in a goal as a player before. Like, I mean, to play that one job. Whereas Rocket League can do that, because you can have the guy who hangs back a bit, but then like can rocket halfway across the pitch in 2 seconds to make the kind of like spin kick header that you can get in. The other side of it is, it is kind of like ping pong in a way, but everybody's a paddle, which is the thing that the other game reminds me of is Rockstar Tennis. Which was the Rockstar's surprisingly good tennis game, or like ping pong game,
that's it,
where you could sort of rotate the paddle in 3D space. And it's the same thing, it's what Tom's talking about. It's like, because your body is the paddle in Rocket League, because it's the chassis of your car that you use to hit the ball however you can, it kind of combines both things. It turns kicking into the act of trying to hit something with a paddle, but it has to be a rocket car paddle, if that makes sense, which it doesn't. But yeah, it's great, and it has a really nice sort of discrete kind of scoring system. So in addition to the goals, which are what count towards the match, a match is always 5 minutes long as well, which is nice. So there's always it's really pacey. If it's a tie, it goes to overtime, in which case it's the first person to score after that wins. But for the most part, there's really tight 5 minute matches. But over the course of that, players also earn points for like saves and clearances and getting the ball on target and shots on goal and stuff like that. So it almost gains that kind of, like, if you're playing with on a just a random server, it has that kind of shooter leaderboard thing of, you know, it's not just about scoring goals to feel that you did well. Like, you can rack up a lot of points by getting like amazing saves, like goal line, you know, diving saves and stuff like that. It's
really incredibly good, basically. It's easily the best multiplayer game I've played this year and probably for a long time.
If you have a PlayStation 4 and you have PS Plus, it's now free to download this month. Huh. So you could just download it, and I might be wrong, but I think it's cross-platform. Hmm. What's brilliant about that is so many PS4 owners are just going to be filling matchmaking matches, so you'll be able to get a game, and it's great.
I would say it is a game you need a pad for. People have said they can play it with a mouse and keyboard, but it's just not designed for that. The game itself says this is...
Can you play it with a full wheel? And
just like trying to park and like flip. Yeah, probably not. It's interesting as well, because like, it's initially completely bewildering, but actually, like I was saying about Rainbow Six earlier, it's one of those games that like starts off totally nuts. And then, Marsh, are you trying to intimidate a songbird by waggling the window at them?
It's a sparrow. I don't think it's technically a songbird. Is a sparrow a songbird? Well, anyway, yes, and it worked. So, well, to limited success, there are too many birds. There are too many birds to scare away.
Part of Marsh's ongoing war against nature, which began when he lived in a graveyard and insects used to try and consume.
I don't have my army of woodlice to scare away that or eat the sparrows anymore.
That's what's happened.
Sorry, you were saying something about video games.
But basically, it's great, and it's a game that's unfortunately difficult to describe in text. It's beautiful to look at. Well, beautiful in its silly kind of blue and orange, Unreal Engine, Trackmania neon rocket cars. Yeah,
cheerfulness to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really does, and it's endlessly entertaining in a way that, like, I mean, we instantly slipped into, because there's a game about two emotions. There are two emotions that apply to Rocket League, and they are yes and no. Like, because everything is like, yes, well, shit, no! And, like, it inadvertently turns every single person who plays it into, like, the Alan Partridge football commentator. Like, it has that kind of, like, I mean, I'm used to shouting at Dota or something, but I don't think I've ever been louder, sorry, Marsh, than the sort of Rocket League, you know, like, twat! Like, when a goal kind of goes in out of fucking nowhere. And, oh, it's so good. A bit hard to describe. But actually, I like it to the point that I want to arrange little in-house cups and stuff. So I'm going to put a post on the forum, see if they're interested. Awesome. Creating Crowbar 2v2 in-house or something. Because it's just crying out for it. Because it's sort of, like, there's already talk of there's some sort of office league or, you know, something like that. Because it's just... You know, maybe we should do the PC Gamer RPS rematch in Rocket League.
That's a good idea.
Yeah,
Adam
loves it.
Yeah.
It's amazing about it. Well, it's like, I wouldn't have guessed, but having seen a screenshot or two of it and read a description about it, that this was a remarkable game, because it sounds, on the face of it, like an Unreal Tournament mod from, like, 2003.
I think it actually was.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I mean, it's such a simple idea, and it's kind of remarkable that no one's done it before, but I think the secret to it is that it is simple, but that everything that could be slightly wrong with it has been addressed or thought of. So, like, you know, just the curved edges of the arena, the fact that slamming into the wall or being slammed into the wall doesn't stop you, but turns it into, like, you can fuck up your shot, but that creates this immediate sense of fluidity, because rather than happening in a box, even though it happens in a rectangle, it happens in a bowl, and that is a more natural environment for a car to be in. I don't drive. I don't have a driving license. But I can tell you that cars belong in bowls. It's very, very good. What have you been playing, Raybo?
I have been playing... In fact, I am right now playing Clicker Heroes, which is an idle game. Which has, I think, just been added to Steam, although I think the game itself came out maybe last year, maybe even earlier than that, and is currently the fifth most popular game on Steam in terms of the number of people playing it. Perhaps because, like me, they are not actually playing it, they are simply leaving it to run in the background. And it's an idle game in the sense that a little monster appears on the right-hand side of the screen, and to start off with, it's snails and flowers and that sort of thing. And their health ticks down over a certain period of time with the damage output that you are currently doing. And as you kill them, either by clicking on them, in which case they die a little bit quicker, or just by waiting for their health to tick down, you get gold.
Die of old age?
Well, you're constantly outputting damage. You have DPS damage per second, but you're constantly attacking even when you're not interacting with it in any way. Or you can click, in which case, well, at this early stage of the game, you get 22 points of extra damage. And then they drop gold, and you use that gold to either unlock new heroes for your party, which increases your DPS, or to level up your existing heroes, which increases your DPS.
Why isn't this game hateful?
Well, it might be. I'm not saying that it's not. And then it becomes about the, you know, the kind of economies of scale of, like, do you wait until you've saved up enough gold in order to unlock a new hero, or do you spend the gold that you've already got in order to level up one of your existing heroes? And every time you kill 10 monsters, you can progress to the next stage within your current environment, and an environment is 10 levels, at the end of which you get a boss, which you... And it's all kill these monsters in the exact same way, but you level up your guys, and then eventually you get to the point of you're able to unlock specific buffs or skills for those characters, which are also passively applied, but they might be a buff that increases their damage output, or it might be an ability which you have to actively apply, which causes you to click 30 times a second for a minute or something, and then there's like a 10-minute cooldown. So I reached kind of stage 20, and there was a boss that I couldn't defeat, and it was the first time I got stuck and couldn't progress past that because there was a time limit on how long you have to kill the bosses. So unlocking this thing allowed me to click that and then click on him on such a rate that I was able to kill him within the time limit and advance onwards.
This is now, what is going on? This sounds like a perfect storm, except, you know, the water and the storm and the boat are all made of shit. It sounds fucking horrible. Why are you playing this?
Because it's the fifth most popular game on Steam right now. Oh, God. I'm curious. And this isn't the first of these idle clicking games which have got into the top 10 on Steam over the last couple of months. There's been like a spate of them being added to the service. And this is, you know, it's free to play, and obviously it has microtransactions in that you can
fucking hell.
You can buy gems.
Another world in which the storm is taking place on is also made of shit.
You can buy gems which allow you to unlock certain skills or what are called gilded heroes, which as far as I can tell are just put out 50 times as much damage as the ones you get for free. But so, like, I'm at a stage now where I'm like level 33 or something like that, and I'm putting out I don't know, like 10,000 DPS a second, and clicking is now completely irrelevant to me because that only does still does 22 damage per second. I haven't found any way to level that up whatsoever. But there's a subreddit for this game in which people are just talking in great detail about different builds and how to maximize your upgrade path and how to put out the highest amount of damage possible, because one of the things that you do is that you'll eventually complete it, you'll eventually get to like the whatever is level 50, level 100 of the kind of progressing through the stages, and at that point you can, as far as I can tell, reset your game to scratch but take one of your heroes and either make them gilded or make them the ascend, I think is the language they use. So you take one of your heroes and they become an ascended hero, and then you play through the entire game again, but now you've got this ascended hero that you're still leveling up on a different thing. And so there's Reddit thread after Reddit threads of just talking about the economics of how to...
Why don't these people just play the stock market?
This is what I was thinking as well. After I was like looking at the wiki, and I found one of the people who is like runs the wiki and is, I think, one of the mods on the subreddit, has a Twitch stream.
If that guy isn't fucking rich, he needs an intervention. Somebody needs to tell him.
The Twitch stream is up 24/7 and has been running for, I think it says, 303 days? actual days? And his damage output has letters in it in a way that makes me not understand the numbers anymore. And when he clicks, that number's got letters in it as well. And so I don't understand what that means. And all his heroes are in the thousands of levels. You know, mine are like level 12 and level 30, and his are like level 3000 and that sort of stuff. And he's got, you know, 22 skills that are passively active at any given time and all this sort of stuff.
Can't be passively and active. That's the whole problem with this game.
But we've talked about these kinds of games on the pod before. Not ones that are expressive like this, but like browser ones. Like, what was the candy one where you got...
Candy
Land? Progress Quest exists.
Well, Progress
Quest. Progress Quest is like a parody of RPGs.
Candy Quest is... Was that
Candy Crush?
No. Candy Quest? Was it one where candies were currency, and then you could either like plant them to grow lollipops or spend them.
You didn't play that in order to just make numbers go up. You played that in order to, you know, at a really kind of meager pace, unlock new bits of that game and find funny things.
Yeah. Mm. They've always been, like, and Progress Quest is funny as well.
And,
like,
and they're all taking the piss out of the fact that the mechanic itself is so fucking abhorrent. I can't believe anybody would voluntarily play that, the naked mechanic of that
but
game.
This is what, like,
min-maxing
people,
the game.
Well, people played Cow Clicker seriously, didn't they?
Yeah, like, that was a direct criticism of, I think, games like Clicker Heroes. I mean, that's what it was. Those games have existed for a long time, mostly on mobile, and only now are coming to Steam, I think. And they were also, they were on Flash, so I think, like, Armor Games or whatever have been hosting Clicker Heroes probably for years now.
I think it traps a certain mindset, I think. Mm. It's a numbers hutch for a certain type of...
Numbers hutch?
Yeah, so you can... It's like...
I think that was a plot device in Lost, wasn't it?
There's the Civ... it's not Civ, SimCity player who got so obsessed with just maximising his city, created these almost obscene, terrifying builds where he crammed as many people, trying to make the most productive city he could. And I think that there are some number systems that it creates the numbers hutch, and you go to the numbers hutch, and it takes you a long time, and you grow to understand every single part of the numbers hutch, you know, how the numbers interact, how they make each other grow and shrink and stuff. And it conveys no benefit to you whatsoever in the rest of your life. But you devote all this, and that's fun for that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who play Diablo. They've smashed through all the monsters in it a dozen times, completed the game multiple times, started over from a harder difficulty, which is just the same as Clicker Heroes Ascension thing. And the reason they keep going though is because they're really into the theory crafting aspect of it. And so there is a way to look at these games, and I'm not saying that this is the way I necessarily look at them or think that's the whole story, but there's a way to look at these games where they just are the theory crafting with the combat ripped out of it, or the combat just happens automatically and you can ignore it.
I can sort of see that, but I wonder if there's something sort of inviolable about the way that actually having to interact with the game, like, preserves us a little bit from the abyss. You know what I mean? Like, just the active... Because I wouldn't say that Diablo has a massive skill ceiling beyond a certain point, but you still need to be able to pull off the build you're telling it to do, and it's still possible to make mistakes that undo your build in interesting ways, or for your build to sacrifice strengths for weaknesses. You know, the possibility of optimal damage if you agree to be weak to a certain thing, and that kind of thing.
Well,
that
active games like Clicker Heroes is about efficiency against time. So it's about how fast can you level up that you're not ever wasting any time. And that's what all the subreddit stuff is about, is if you're starting from scratch, here's the way in which to maximize your leveling thing. So you can make wrong choices. It's just that they only bite you in the sense that now it's maybe going to take you an extra day to level something that you could have done much quicker if you'd done it in a slightly different order. And at the kind of top end, like I watched a little bit of this 24/7 live stream, and, you know,
please tell me you're writing about this. This isn't just something you're doing for fun.
Well, I figured I'd talk about it in the podcast and then maybe write about it, would be. But, like, enemies are taking 6 or 7 minutes to kill each, and so obviously even though he's putting out a huge amount of damage, he's at such a high level now where things are taking a long, long time. And so there is still some sense of punishment if you make a wrong choice. So that makes the choices interesting, perhaps.
You know, what I would argue that Diablo 3 learned was that making wrong choices isn't actually interesting. Making wrong plays is interesting. That's why Diablo 3 took away the idea that your build would bind you into something forever. Mm-hmm. Because a choice in Diablo 2 that means your character is just a big bit of dump now means that you're kind of stuck being inefficient forever, and there's not a huge amount you can do about it.
Diablo 3 is an interesting case study, because as you were describing the game, I was thinking, yeah, it'd be really hypocritical for me to, you know, attack this for because I played Diablo 3 fucking for hundreds of hours. But at the same time, the way I played Diablo 3 wasn't to min-max builds, and I wasn't interested in running the hardest mode as quickly as possible, or any of the kind of goals that the Diablo community sets itself. The game never asks you to do that, actually. I know what the best build for this barbarian is if I want to get through this game very quickly, but that's not fun to me, because it means just being, having the fucking whirlwind skill and just being a whirlwind for the entire game. I'd rather, you know, explore all the other skills and see all the interesting chain reactions that they cause. My point being that there's actually a game there, aside from the Critical Path game that everyone, some people will play the top 2% of people might play that game to get through things as fast and quickly as possible, but there's also the rest of the stuff and all the secret kind of, you know.
Yeah, but just because a game that just was about that 2% wouldn't necessarily be bad.
Yeah.
Or in this case, I think, like, Clicker always has nice things, so, like, the monsters that you're killing are kind of funny looking, and it makes really satisfying noises when you click on them, and the gold that spews out of them is really shiny and tinkly, and it feels nice
to collect. Okay, I'm sold.
And that sort of stuff. So it's not made without any sense of artifice, but...
Carry on.
Birds continues.
I think it's, like... I think it's a game that probably should be torn to shreds for a bunch of different reasons, but I'm wary of tearing to shreds the people who enjoy that game.
Yeah. Well, I don't deny their enjoyment. I just think maybe some people need to be protected from themselves.
Well, it kind of feels to me...
You said the most patronising thing in the world.
Yeah. It feels to me like it's accountancy with friends. Like, basically, like, it's you know, they're min-maxing and it's all about numbers and spreadsheets and economics, but they're all on the subreddit. Talking.
Isn't that why we have Eve?
They're all on the subreddit talking to each other. And I think there's maybe in-game chat as well, and I think I read something that I think they were going to add clans, so you could actually, like, form up with other players in order to infect your number.
That's number clans.
This is definitely number one. But there is, like, a social aspect to it, which means that it's... I don't know, redeems it in part in my head, because it no longer feels like the crazy people are lonely.
You can do... You can...
Said, actually, the second most popular in the world.
I feel so bad about, like, second-guessing someone's enjoyment of a thing, but there comes a point where it's like... And this is a risky stone to throw, given what we're interested in. But there's got to come a point where you think about the value of your time and investment in the thing.
Well, and whales are a phenomenon in you know, gambling circles. So people who have certain predilections are exploited by certain game mechanics to the benefit of the people who make those games. I mean, I don't know if that's particularly the case here, whether though the people who enjoy this game are also the same people who are likely to spend the microtransactions to excess.
Mm.
But certainly they are locked into some kind
what
of
those people be like?
Well, it was this story that was going around a couple of weeks ago, I think, the person who was the best in the world at Game of War Fire Age, or one of those kind of iPad... town management invasion games.
Shite-em-ups.
Yeah. It wasn't Game of War Fire Age, it was one of the other ones, but he was spending like $10,000 a month in order to be the top of the leaderboard in this game. And he had like four different iPads, so he could be playing on four accounts simultaneously, but then trading stuff between them in order to max it. And then he had like fans who would, like, one of them sent him an iPad so he could do better. Eventually, he got a job with one of the development studios.
How was he paid for it without a job?
Well, he had a job before, but now he works for one of the game developers that was designing these games. But there are certainly instances where people who want to be the best at these things spend huge amounts of money.
But be the best at spending money.
See, it's personal responsibility, though, isn't it? Like, you can't go to those people and say you can't do that. Like, if that's what you want to do, and you've got the money.
Oh, yeah, but we can criticise the industry which facilitates that kind of behaviour.
You can sort of say caveat emptor to a degree, but beyond that, it's sort of like, how much are we inviting nuclear fire? You know what I mean? Like, you know.
But we do have rules and regulations that, you know, determine the extent of, that prevent gambling addiction to some degree or another. Ineffectually.
Yeah, I think. Something like Candy Quest or Progress Quest, I sort of give a buy for being passive because, A, you're sort of doing it in the pursuit of a different kind of reward, sort of the funny, the jokes, or whatever else it is. And maybe something to be said for that with art style, discovering new parts of the game, and just the pleasure of progression. And I'm really not the person to second-guess that too much because I wrote a thing yesterday about the pleasure of participating in something, and sometimes that has a financial element. I do have a problem when there is microtransactions hanging off that kind of thing, though, especially when they expedite because like the game is about progress, right? Like the game is about efficiency, and you can spend money to become more efficient. So therefore, the efficient way to play the game about efficiency is to spend money. Therefore, is it a game about spending money?
Yeah.
And that's for me, and this is, I don't know. For me, that's where it crosses over into like the fringes of irresponsible without knowing too much about it, because like it's a bit like, you know, because there are people who are vulnerable to that in the form of the phrase "a day to spend loads of money," and they're like, "Oh, I don't think I should," and they're like, "Oh, dare you? I'll show you a picture of Kate Upton," and then and they're like, "Oh, okay then," and yeah, and then it happens, and it's like that's not really like a game at that point. That's a trick.
Yeah, I see what you're saying with it.
Did you enjoy it?
Well, I mean, I played it for an hour and it was nice enough. Sometimes it is satisfying for numbers to go up and to level up, have a sense of progress. The gold coins do make really satisfying sounds. And when you level up and suddenly 25 of them are coming out of each enemy and your money number is going up faster than it was before, it's about, oh, it's exciting, I like that. But at the same time, no, I'm like fascinated by the people who are super into this, but I'm not ever going to be super into this myself. What I'm also interested in, though, is the fact that the other clicker games that have been on Steam before, there was one a couple of months ago that was in the top 10 on Steam, and now it's not. So, but given that these games are often functionally endless, like, I'm curious about how does the swell of people that suddenly pile on this game when it launches, at what point do they all just, like...
just another game come offers one DPS extra damage or something.
Or just, like a wave of personal revelations that periodically sweeps the earth as people go, hang on, and they never play again.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that it gets solved. Because, you know, you can invent an incredibly complex number trap, but the crowd will solve it in about a couple of months, surely.
Yeah, maybe that's it. And maybe once it's been solved, maybe it's no longer satisfying to play, even if you yourself haven't yet applied that solution.
So if that sort of game had a bi-monthly meta update that changed the rules slightly,
like, and seasons,
extra and layers of kind of more compelling mechanics above the ones that you already have, then people will probably play them for longer.
If you are a player of this game, listeners, I'm sorry I called you mentally ill, but please write in to fully describe the parameters of your mental illness.
I mean, yeah, because like, you don't want to kind of discount it, and it is dangerous territory because there's so many games that skirt the edge of this. Like Hearthstone is a game that skirts the edge of this in some ways, but it's also very skill-based and strategic in a lot of ways. And maybe it's wrong or outdated to say that it's the moment-to-moment skill element that allows a numbers-based efficiency element to be there and have a purpose as a part of the game design and not just be a fucking, like, a little massage machine that just squeezes the part of your brain that all it wants to know is whether it's going to survive the winter. And all it does is say, yes! Yeah, but, and maybe it's naive to say that those games like Diablo and Hearthstone are okay because you have to, because you can fuck it up in the moment and there's a skill there, whereas these games are bad because all they are is the efficiency element and the game plays itself. But I really do agree with that thing I just said.
What have either of you chaps been playing, Tom and Marsh?
I could briefly talk about Ark, colon, Survival Evolved.
Another game in the top 10 Steam.
It is, yeah, just while I was playing it, I just wanted to figure out. And Marsh will be delighted to learn that it's a game about being naked and then picking up, in an open world and online environment, and then picking up things off the floor and then turning them into slightly bigger things that enable you to survive better. It's one of those games, one of Marsh's favourite genres. Yeah. But this one has dinosaurs in it.
Yeah, that did tempt me, but not enough.
Wasn't there already one of these, or like two of these?
There's a lot of them now, because...
with dinosaurs.
Loads of them. Survival Evolved looks very nice, very pretty. I've not done much in it at all. I was spawned... first of all, it gives you the option to create a character, and it gives you this absurd parody of a human male to be, if you want. So I chose this kind of ridiculous squat, kind of men's health front cover, but times two with steroids, and then decided to become that guy. Spawned on a beach. A very small dodo walked up to me, so I left-clicked, punched it square in the fucking beak. There's a big splat of blood, and it kind of just kept on walking. So I punched it again, and it kind of some more blood, and then just kind of like squawked, and then kept on walking. And it's great. Then I looked up, and it was like a really shit version of Jurassic Park, where there were loads of dinosaurs, and it really doesn't cheat you out of the dinosaurs. It's not like you have to become level 100 to see a dinosaur. In fact, there are all the fucking dinosaurs you want everywhere all the time. There's the fucking population immigration problem on the tiny island you're spawned on. I looked up, and there was like a Brachiosaurus, whatever, and like there was a Triceratops right next to it, and then there were more dodos, and then there's a pterodactyl just standing in the middle of the dodos, and none of them were looking at each other or interacting in any way. And any sense that this place had an ecology or any kind of, you know, interactive world system just vanished immediately, because it is a more laughable version of Far Cry 3 when you had ocelots and cassowaries just kind of coexisting peacefully side by side within the same bush sometimes, if you're in a certain place.
The latter hours of a awkward dinosaur dinner party.
And then, yeah, they're also, but it's almost like Virginia Woolf, where something's gone wrong at the dinner party and none of them are looking at
each
other.
That's what I mean. Like George Osborne played, but with dinosaurs.
everything's just really awkward. You've walked in on it and it's like, whoa, guys, I would give you some space, but I need to bludgeon you to death for some meat, otherwise I will not survive the night. And it was, yeah, and I started playing and started to get onto the, When you start these games, you start to glimpse at the endless curve of things you have to build in order to make other things to build. And that's the moment where I just switch off and go,
wouldn't it be better if you could advance through that curve without having to actually do anything? Just leave it running in the background.
Exactly. The awkward
dinner. You can see that. As a way of nullifying the survival genre.
Maybe they could cancel each other out.
Two of Marsh's greatest enemies will die overnight.
Did you encounter any other players?
No, I did encounter their creations, though.
Oh.
And the coolest part about it was that I just huddled in their creation, and like I was cold. So, well, the game told me it was cold. There's a fucking meter for it. It's like, you are cold now. So I went into one of their little kind of thatch roof buildings and kind of camped in there for a bit and started a little fire. And the sense of going into someone else's structure and kind of illicitly stealing their space and using it was actually really quite nice, actually. It was quite interesting. But I didn't see any other players, and even though the server had like 50 people on it, I didn't see anyone. And apparently, just like I was on the Reddit and stuff, there are still parts of the game. It's still, I believe, in early access and quite unfinished in many ways. So someone had found a patch under a lake where there is just air. It looked like a water texture was floating, but actually underneath there were, like, he'd started a farm, and was like, so, you know, it was ingenious, really, that he'd found this place. But
called it Rapture.
No, but it's like a glitch Rapture, where you don't have to build any walls for, you know, things to grow. So he had like his, you can tame dinosaurs apparently, and eventually just have them in farms and things.
You can ride them around, including I think the flying ones, maybe pterodactyls. Or some other kind of flying dinosaur.
I didn't see anyone doing that. I'd have been enamoured with the game much more if I'd seen people doing that in a kind of World of Warcraft sense, where you go into a big city in World of Warcraft and you see loads of people flying dragons and stuff. But there was none of that really. I came across mysterious things. Like I found a bay, and there's this huge kind of sandy expanse, and there was a massive wall that someone had built with an open gate, and it looked like a giant pen for huge dinosaurs, but it was empty, mysteriously deserted. And it made me curious to find out, like, what do people keep here? What is this for? And that sense of just found, abandoned, player-made geometry is actually really nice and really cool. And that's something that, like, things like Rust are trying to emulate as well. However, it did share, like, there seems to be a lot of bugs with it, and there seems to be a lot of problems. And I basically don't have faith that any of these games are ever going to be finished.
No.
That's my bigger problem with it. I just, they always seem to be permanently in early access, and it just reminds me of DayZ, where it's, like, a really exciting idea with so much promise, and then actually it just goes on and on and on, and the players realise it's not going to turn into anything.
They just keep picking up mechanics from each other and combining them into bigger mechanics infinitely, and it's sort of like stacking, kind of, yeah.
And then never fixing the fact that zombies can still walk through walls or whatever. So yeah, I mean, it's a shame really, because it's actually a really exciting genre, but there's very little kind of excellent execution of it.
Ark seems a little bit further along in terms of, I think it's being regularly updated at this stage. I mean, unlike the Stomping Land, which was dinosaur survival game that got a bunch of attention when it first came out.
Yeah, I remember standing inside a Triceratops and just inside one.
Does that happen in an Ace Ventura movie? That's a rhino.
Ark looks nice. There's a lot of things, like, there aren't just basic physics errors. You can walk around and not just see obnoxious shit happening around you. Like, it's clearly just, there's a fidelity to it that actually doesn't exist in most of the survival early access games I've tried, which is a small benefit. But, you know, if you go and play any game of any other genre, you just expect that. You expect it to be, you expect that. So, yeah. Mm.
Does apparently as well do the thing that Rust does, where when players log out of the server, their body remains in game as a sleeping form, which means that you'll spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours getting all the resources, crafting everything, building your little house, taming your turtle friend, giving him a name, building yourself your little fort, and then as soon as you log off, some new player has picked up a stone. Just banging against the outside wall of your house for 15 minutes until it smashes, and then just beat you to death inside while you're asleep. So you just log back in and spawn on the beach, and everything you built and loved will have gone.
Oh no. That's definitely, I'm never going to play that again now.
I played Rust for exactly 5 minutes, and that's pretty much what I did. I broke into somebody's house, but there wasn't anyone there. Then I left and saw there was another naked man lying on the beach, so I killed him, took his rock, and then logged off forever.
I feel like these games have really interesting feature ideas, and then just write them down on their to-do list in the wrong order. Like, that's the thing that you should add much further down once you've added the ability for players to set up defences that would prevent it or any of those other things.
Also, it's not really these games are so much about the fantasy of having a game that's actually realistic and asks you to do all of the mundane things you'd be asked to do in real life, and the fidelity, the lack of abstraction is a big part of it. But if someone hits you with a rock when you're asleep, you know, it's not going to happen every time, but you might wake up and fight back. Your turtle might come crashing through the wall and say, and like, you know, and stop it or something. And whereas, I don't know. but, you know, like, so the idea that, you know, when you're asleep, you're fully vulnerable is actually not an abstraction. Sorry, it is an abstraction. That's not realistic.
They're very selectively simulatory, those games, in a way which I think the developers and communities that have surrounded them are somewhat dishonest in recognising.
In ARK Survival Evolved, you look at your inventory by looking at a microchip embedded in your wrist that then beams your inventory into your eyes. It's like, if I've got that,
why are you keeping the stuff?
Well, that's a very, very good question as well. That's never explained. Maybe it's in your fucking arm chip. If you've got that kind of technology, why can't I make dinosaurs fly and whatever?
I mean,
wasn't there a survival game that Chris Livingston played for PC Gamer in which you literally stored stuff up your butt?
Yeah, like a rock.
He put a rock up there.
Kept it there for a while.
Yeah, and
that sounds like him.
You could also hit yourself with your own inventory objects.
Oh, yeah.
So he took the rock out of his butt and hit himself in the face with it to kill himself when he got stuck.
And that was his article headline sort of thing. Literally.
Yep.
I was thinking recently about why DayZ was so successful and every other, and I love DayZ, and every other game in this genre, as far as I can tell, is a big load of shit. And I think the reason actually is because DayZ was a mod, and because it was something that had been layered onto a game world that had been invented for something else. Like, as a sort of related conversation about how, like, why DayZ is one of the weirdly most convincing post-apocalypses in games. And it's because the environment the game takes place in wasn't designed for the thing you're doing in it, which is the key to a post-apocalypse, right? Like, you know, there are multiple versions of it. There's the kind of, like, the pure Mad Max Fury Road version, where in the many years after the post-apocalypse, the world slips purely into allegory. You know what I mean? Like, everything is mega heightened and cartoonish. And then there's a lot of stuff that sort of exists on the fringe of, like, you know, it's a destroyed society with new stuff cropping up. The great thing about DayZ, the reason it's so compelling, is it really comes across that this is happening in the weeks and months after everyone else has been killed by something and their bodies have mysteriously vanished, but whatever. Because, as in that real fantasy of a zombie apocalypse, it's not happening in pre-designed spaces or specifically designed spaces or in, you know, ramshackle sheds that players are throwing up around them. It's happening in office buildings and supermarkets and abandoned tenement blocks and hospitals. And because the game world in its entirety was designed to be traversed in, you know, Black Hawk helicopters on the way to a, you know, a proper modern military simulation, crossing it on foot feels weirdly subversive. Like, you're not supposed to be doing it. Like it does in real life. If you cut across land that's not yours, or you try and walk somewhere where the distance is actually too far. And, you know, it, there's that sort of feeling of like...
There's lots of boring countryside in DayZ, which actually adds to the sense of fidelity.
Yeah, and it's because it was designed to be, you know, it wasn't designed for that game to be played in. Mm. Like, if there's any credence to the thing Dean Hall said at the Microsoft conference at E3, which sounded pretty dumb at the time when he stood up and the first thing he said was, I want a game, there's not a game. Which I think is still a bit arch, but there is something to be said for the fact that DayZ is a game world that wasn't designed to be that game world, and therefore fits perfectly with the subject matter, and is somehow weirdly kind of gains huge amounts from it, whereas every subsequent survival game, because of the crafting mechanics and the stuff that goes with it, apart from maybe The Long Dark, which I think gets away, which does better, but it's maybe more because it is a game about survival.
I think there's enough of armor in DayZ to make player interactions more interesting than any other survival game. So the most fascinating parts of DayZ were when you see another player and that sense of fear, even at a great distance, because they might have a gun and you look at their silhouette and it tells you things about them. There's a wider range of equipment they have, and their equipment works, unlike a lot of the equipment in a lot of half-made survival games. Whereas in Rust, it's like you're both naked and you both could have a rock. There are only so many things that are going to be able to happen in that scenario.
The vocabulary of a rock is limited.
Exactly. Whereas the vocabulary of all the tools that are built into ARM already that were working when the DayZ mod was already just starting, they were all in place. And there were a load of things that you could do. You could tie people up, drive people around. You could threaten them with guns. If you had a melee weapon, that changed things. If you're a small building, like, there are a lot of different situations that could arise. You could talk to each other. And that created communities, and it created stories, and it created videos that people would share. Whereas I walk into most half-made survival games and just the player versus the player and player interactions just aren't advanced in any way, and you can't actually do any of that stuff. And then that becomes immediately boring, because then it's another clicking game about gathering things and turning them into other things.
I wonder if part of it is the fact that DayZ was substantially luck-based rather than crafting-based, because it wasn't about crafting treadmill.
Yeah.
It was about what you found. It's far more realistic. Like, crafting is, you know, you're talking about things about these ostensibly realistic games that are a little bit disingenuous. Crafting is one of them. Not every human being can make everything out of everything else. Like, we're not born like that. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, if I was stranded naked in the wilderness tomorrow, I would not know how to punch a tree until I could make a pickaxe.
You literally do that in Ark. You have to punch trees to get wood. It's really funny. Yeah. Because your character screams in pain every time you punch a tree. You've gained one wood. But you have to do that, just to subject yourself to that to actually build it.
That's what I mean. Like, whereas the DayZ thing of like going breaking into someone's house and finding a backpack and that being amazing is cues a little bit closer to real life. There's tons of stuff that's abstract about it. But that little emotional moment of like, oh god, this is precious and I want to keep it now, and that man's going to try and take it, so I've got to run away. Like, all of those things get a little bit closer to the bone than like, I spent a long time creating this pen for my turtle, but a man murdered me in my sleep. Like, I can't really think of the post-apocalyptic story where that's the ending. You know?
Should we do questions?
From questions?
Yeah, that's where we get them.
Yep. All right, let's do it. Dear Crated Crew, it seems to me that Deus Ex Human Revolution serves a similar role in Crate and Crowbar discussions as Far Cry 2 did for the Idle Thumbs podcast. Not just a common reference point, but a major example of worthwhile game mechanics, a dominating in-group cultural touchstone, repeated riff generator, general all-around UR text, etc. If I'm not entirely off-base with this analogy, then what's the CNC/Deus Ex version of Idle Thumbs' invocation of a, quote, a grenade rolling down a hill, end quote, in Far Cry 2? Thanks for the great shows. Keep casting those pods. Dale.
What does that mean?
I'm not familiar enough.
It's something which creates such an instinctual adoration in the audience, because everybody loves a grenade rolling down a hill.
So the grenade rolling down a hill is like, I can't remember, this is many, many years of Idle Thumbs ago, but it is the indicator for one of those kind of moments of like emergent systemic nonsense that kind of proves why that game's great. I actually struggle to think of a Deus Ex example, because like, I can't really think of a time when that game has misbehaved in a way that's been really funny or...
Yeah, it doesn't really do that kind of emergent shenanigans in combat scenarios in the same way as Far Cry does. I think our probably most reference point there, mostly just because it's me and Tom F. bringing it up, is the ability to stack two bodies on top of each other and then shish kebab them simultaneously with your fist chisels.
Who doesn't like that?
Which is an example of one of the reasons why DX is great.
I think in terms of examples that we've collectively had of systemic stuff happening. Tom S. dropping that knife into my brain during our group
Spelunky
video is probably the loudest noise we've ever made collectively. In terms of comic timing, and thankfully, saving this bit, something we can link to in the show notes that you can watch rather than just hear us describe.
Actually, I think Spelunky is a better touchstone for the entire group than Deus Ex is, generally. Like, we just talked about it so much, and it does that kind of emergent chaos that...
Don't we all love Far Cry 2 as well? Why isn't that one of our touchstones? I love Far Cry 2.
I think everybody who loves that game got the talking about it out of their systems before we started this podcast.
That's pretty true, yeah.
I think Spelunky is a better touchstone because it's a game we all like. But you shouldn't talk about it anymore because we talked about it for a billion episodes.
We should only talk about it. Daniel writes, "Greetings, cratings out of Den and Crowbar. Firstly, congratulations on reaching episode 100. Yada, yada, yada. So well done, I guess. Yada, yada, yada. My question is about whether you think gaming is taken less seriously in wider culture because of its tendency to work within the fantasy and science fiction genres. Yeah. Looking at a few top 100 lists for book and film, genre fiction is definitely a minority, but the top 10 PC games on PC Gamer's last list are nearly always science fiction or fantasy games at the end for reference. Given the relatively low place sci-fi and fantasy occupy on the cultural totem pole, will games always struggle to be taken seriously while they lean towards these genres? Daniel?
No, I'd say, because I think the cultural totem pole is shifting. I think things like sci-fi and fantasy are on the ascendant. Like, I mean, Game of Thrones is being taken, if not completely seriously, as literary fiction, and it's certainly become a lot more present in the cultural zeitgeist than it would have been, you know, 10 years ago or something like that. And I think that's true Battlestar Galactica as well, also taken semi-seriously. I think this stuff is just rising to the top in everybody's consciousness now, and I don't think people are that picky, really, in terms of, you know, differentiating between genre fiction and serious stuff. The reason that games tend towards genre fiction is because genre fiction tends to deal with events that have kind of more actionable elements within a game setting, whereas you can't really have a novel of ideas presented via a video game. Jack Kerouac's on the road as a video game would be, I mean, it's not impossible, but
you're not going to play like
you're not going to kill many goblins in that game.
Super Enduring Love Turbo.
This is a jam.
The Ian McEwan game jam. On Chesil Beach Online. First Love, Last Rites 2.
I'm starting to see why games don't do that. Yeah. The more we get at it.
Do you agree though? Do you think that stuff is on the ascendant in culture in general? It's not going to be a...
I think there are standout examples, and I still think that, like, it's critically frowned upon by mainstream journalists. Like, I think a fantasy novel like Game of Thrones, like a series, will be considered as a kind of, a piece of throwaway entertainment, but I don't think it'll ever be taken. It's not taken seriously.
I think that's true. Really? I think one thing that's been really interesting about the rise of Game of Thrones has been watching more traditional or, snooty, indeed, cultural critical outlets bend over backwards to not call it fantasy in order to be able to talk about it. as in the snootiness about genre fiction remains, but Game of Thrones gets rehabilitated in this. Well, it's actually about politics and people and sexual politics, and there are dragons in it, but it's actually about politics. And there's that unwillingness to just let genre collapse away a little bit and see it for what it is.
You see it, and there's a kind of double standards, a place like Waterstones, for example, where do they place books in their store? And there's a fantasy section, but there's also like a literary section, and things like Murakami gets to be promoted into the literary section.
But that's science fiction, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Science fiction, you know, fantasy as well. But he has a kind of clout for many reasons. He's great. I love Murakami stuff, but I think there's a slight exoticism to the fact it's come from Japan that gives it a kind of credence. It's for no reason, but,
a certain kind of fantasy is urban fantasy, or it's a kind of psychological fantasy. It's like, as soon as people see fucking orcs or dragons in a thing, they still think...
There's kind of imps and stuff in Murakami. Like, Murakami gets really... I mean, it's kind of a bit horror-y sometimes, the kind of horror in social, in recognisable social environments. So I guess it's not total, like, Warcraft or anything, is it? But I don't know. I think there's a, kind of hypocrisy to put Murakami in there and not other types of fantasy.
But you see, I mean, like Margaret Atwood and Ursula Le Guin are both completely rehabilitated. Well, if they were unhabilitated in the first place, like they've had successful literary careers. I think people take them pretty seriously as authors, and both of them have written, you know, science fiction.
Sure.
And obviously, Ursula Le Guin's written some great fantasy as well.
Yeah, there's always people who work within these fields who manage to ascend, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the genre itself is now seen as acceptable in those circles. No. It's as Chris says, Game of Thrones is justified as, oh, it's not really fantasy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, like...
Well, I think,
like,
that's the tip of, you know, that's the point at which things are changing. Right?
I think, yeah, I think within any art, within any creative medium, there is a sort of a stratification that comes about through a really complex mix of sometimes genuine, you know, degrees of sophistication within that medium. But also just the full on pleasure of stratifying some shit so you get, you know, I mean, and those, you know, so it's almost like the kind of the cultural side of it where, you know, the idea of what is literary arrives and then suddenly carries with it loads of social benefits for people who are brought into that club and so on, and needs to be exclusive by its principle. It doesn't mean that books that are literary are undeserving, that it's all cliques and it's all a scene and there's nothing else to it, because there's a degree of sophistication that spurs that in the first place. But the social side of it, and there's the very basic human weakness that makes people want to be protective of their club, basically, calcifies that into something else. And it expands.
It's generational, though. Those people die.
And it grows in different ways, but that process will repeat itself.
I also think this is that actually the internet has had a huge part in this, in that fan groups for things like Game of Thrones can be so vocal that it's impossible for an outlet like The Guardian to not cover it. Or 50 Shades, you know.
Money does eventually force people
to find out. The fact that, you know, if you want people to read stuff, then you want to be writing about the stuff that the Zeitgeist has latched onto.
It's much harder to be snooty on the internet when you're writing for Google and SEO, basically.
Mm. So, I think 10 years ago, The Guardian would have, for example, just picking The Guardian randomly, but any kind of mainstream publication, would have done two paragraphs on 50 Shades and said, oh, isn't this cute, and then left it alone forever. But I think now, given the exposure it's had, and to want to be part of the discussion and kind of draw people in and have people reading your words on your website, then you have to cover it. And that has dissolved a lot of the kind of snobbery around Game of Thrones and other things.
I don't think it was dissolved the snobbery around 50 Shades. Because,
oh, that's true. Actually, like, in fact, the guy just take this out of that relationship.
Laughing at 50 Shades is...
But I enjoy that.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons for its popularity.
Yeah, I love that shit in Venice. But, yeah.
Is there going to be a thing when we're... Are we going to be snobbish against a particular genre? Can you see a genre coming?
Well, this is the thing, like, we almost did it earlier. Like, you know, basically, we'll get to this point where, you know, there'll be, you know, people... We already do it.
Yeah.
Like, we already do it right now. Snobs. We do it with YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, we go, like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I meant specifically, like, a literary genre.
Oh, okay, yeah, but, like...
Or, you know, a genre of fiction.
Oh, do you mean like if a whole form like that could span media? So like,
yeah, as well. So slash fiction is this something that presumably would be derided.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to anticipate something that doesn't exist and that you would dislike because you're old. But but like, you know, I mean, the gaming is already very much stratified away from stuff, and we have loads of ideas what a game should be that is defied by a game that where you don't click on things, and you know, maybe. Maybe someday someone will be sitting on a podcast like this one talking about how when will our passive numberthons be accepted into, you know, mainstream, into the mainstream, well, the gaming critical, you know, elite.
Why isn't the New Statesman writing about clicker heroes?
Yeah, exactly. And those people are wrong. Martin taking his head for good reason, but but nonetheless, they may exist and they may have similar grievances to ours. So. Perhaps you're right that it's a generational thing, and with time, and
we'll die, and
eventually
they will win.
The oblivion of all that is, no one will care.
Hooray!
Nick writes, "Dear Creighton Crowbar, I can't tell you how excited I am to have my email read in a British accent. So have at it, gents." I wanted to ask you about the term tilt. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with the term or not, but in case you are not, tilt means to gamble recklessly and aggressively after a bad or improbable beat or series of bad or improbable beats.
The term is from poker, mostly, but I've seen it used for competitive games and experience it myself sometimes when playing League of Legends. I have a problem with games in that I find it hard to walk away from a loss, so I keep pushing for a win and find myself going on tilt, therefore making that chance of a win less and less. This can even happen in single-player games if you're having a hard time. I usually have to force myself to walk away and do something else. What instances have you all gone on tilt, and what, if anything, did you do about it? Also, do game devs discuss and plan for such a problem, even with single-player games? Thanks for the lovely podcast, and keep it up. Nick from Colorado.
I really like this question. I used to play poker in casinos, in grubby casinos in Birmingham, like proper tournaments where you'd be there until like 3 a.m. if you were doing well. And like part of playing poker is recognizing tilt.
Hmm.
And it's really interesting because it's about kind of stepping outside of yourself and recognizing your own behavior. And when you're being, when your logical decision making has been interrupted by emotion in some way, a lot of poker is about controlling emotions. It, when you play it over a period of 5 hours, because you're kind of being worn down and you're constantly being asked to be a machine and calculate odds all the time. And I think it gets in the way that with that will reduce your efficiency. And tilt is amazing because once you recognize it, it's like a kind of mind disease, like that just it takes you over and just completely ruins all of your decision making. And it's definitely a thing that happens in games all the time. For example, like even earlier this evening, I was talking to my girlfriend who's just started playing Batman Arkham Knight, and she went on tilt playing attempting the first Riddler underground racetrack challenge, which it hits you with very early on during a compressed tutorial period before you've even been able to drive the Batmobile very much. So you get to drive around the streets for about, you know, 10 minutes. And then one of the first kind of story missions is you've got to do this in difficult track that requires you to, drive along upside down and on walls while also pressing a separate button to make walls and ramps come out of the track in order to complete it. And actually it's a really advanced challenge for, you know, the amount of you've been exposed to that vehicle that you're driving. And she tried it again and again and again. She was like furious with it. I could hear her. She was like, you can hear her. And she said that she would have thrown the controller against the wall if it hadn't been my PS4, because she'd have to pay for like another 50 quid controller. But, she just put it down and she got on tilt, because the main thing about tilt is that you're convinced that the way you can fix everything is to win at the thing you're doing immediately. And that's the overriding instinct, is that this is going wrong. I'm wrong because this is going wrong. The only short-term fix, and the only thing I'm going to fixate on is fixing that by doing it right. And it's the worst thing you can do. It's like this spiral of emotion that just drags you into incompetence. And of course, if you're frustrated and you're thinking logically or reacting or just relaxed, then you're going to be wrong. You're going to hit that barrier. You're going to make that shitty play in your shitty casino in Birmingham somewhere and get thrown out. And it's really interesting. It translates directly onto games. And that's not even in a competitive context.
No. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, Dark Souls as well is a big one for that, isn't it? Because obviously when you get beaten by a boss, say, 50 times in a row or something like that, as I think I've observed Santon, then, you know, your instinct is just to kind of fucking wail on this guy and try and, you're like, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to get you. And of course you just can't be that, aggressive.
Classic story is that, I put the pad down, I went to sleep, and I came back to it and beat it first time the next day.
Yeah.
And it's because you were on tilt. It's because your emotions were actually wrecking your ability to do that task. It's so true. And actually, we should link to the battle against, is it the Four Kings?
Oh, God, yeah.
Which is the defining example of Rich Sampson's playthrough of being on
tilt. That might have also been alcohol as well. As well as some tilt.
That doesn't help either, I suppose.
Yeah. You must have examples from this.
I have exactly the same example, word for word, that you just told about Batman. I could say the same words. Be a different person, obviously.
Well, I hope so.
But it would be the same words in the same order to say the same thing. I'm going to give you examples because I play this game called Dota sometimes, and that is a game that is about people not tilting. It is a game. It's been compared to poker, and for a reason that it's about maintaining your emotions and making efficient decisions over time, basically, in a circumstance where not only do you have to worry about your own, but the people who are ostensibly trying to help you sometimes do things that are unhelpful to you. And tilt manifests in a bunch of complex ways, because it's not just tilting in terms of your own ability. It's tilting in terms of your ability to handle other people tilting. So you have, like, you can have fucking tilt dominoes. But you can have an entire team tilt individually. But you can have some, like, tilt into each other and, like, turn it into, like, a sort of tilt Voltron, where you kind of summon a massive tilt.
Yeah.
And that's called the throw, really, when it happens. And managing that is hard. Like, you've got to recognize, because you're right, the key to solving it in your own play is recognition. It's the moment you go, this is happening to me, and I'm going to, and then what I think that does is it changes the problem from I have to solve losing to I have to solve tilting.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing. You can keep losing while, but if you're fixing the tilt, then you're actually on a better path to winning. Which is, you know, we lost a game this weekend in the Games Industry Dirt Tournament I'm playing because of tilting, and specifically because of getting frustrated with other people. And the hardest thing in that situation is to tell the person who is getting frustrated that the reason that we're losing is not because those, well, it's partly that those people are tilting and making mistakes, but we are now losing because we are dwelling on them and because we are trying to brute force a solution when the answer is just to calm the fuck down. And it's you know, it's one of the reasons these games are so interesting, is because I think multiplayer it's a positive force almost, because it becomes this sort of dynamic that you have to handle. It's like an additional game mechanic, which is just people, and it's really interesting because it's, you know, people being tortured by a system until other people have to make them better in order for the right thing to happen. But the example of Batman is kind of what I was going to bring up, because it's like, what point is it undesirable? Because Dark Souls actually, you know, that's part of the fun of the game again, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Dark Souls builds its resource system around that as well. Like, you know, it almost, you know, the interesting rhythm of failing repeatedly in Dark Souls is, you go in, you think you can do it, you fail, you lose your stuff, and then it's probably the point where you give up getting your souls back.
Yeah.
It's like when you're on tilt. Like, it's almost like there's like a little measure for it in the game, which is when you're like, you've got nothing to lose anymore, and you're just fucking running it and like,
please just die.
Yeah. Whereas it rewards you for being more diligent, because you ultimately will come out of the fight with more if you play more calmly and focus on like being efficient and so on. But in the Batman case, which I think is a really good example, I don't think it's desirable, because it, that first Riddler challenge, and there's a few other examples of this, is a stiff difficulty spike that is completely optional. So the only reason that you would overcommit to it is if you were tilting.
Yeah.
And, I remember being in exactly the situation that Tom found himself in and thinking, come back to this. Like, go and drive the Batmobile around the open world, do other things, because this game is great and there's so much to it. And you're completely ruining your experience of the game by fixating on this. So, and that's a problem for the game designer. That's when it becomes a thing where you can't just leverage tilt as an interesting kind of human mechanic to create challenge within your game, because it's preventing people from playing it anymore. And I think it's also one of the reasons that game's been panned as much as it has for the Batmobile section, because they are problematic, but they're another thing that you tilt on. Right. Whether it's the, you know, the optional kind of wave survival bits that happen to get harder and harder, or admittedly the kind of the mandatory stuff that happens during the campaign. Because they're tricky in a kind of instant fail, they're almost like, if there's a set of criteria that promotes tilting, you know, where some game mechanics do and some game mechanics don't, Batman's tank stuff is the closest to it than any of its other mechanics, because you can fuck up Predator and there's leeway to get away. You can fuck up combat and there's leeway to get away, whereas the tank stuff is a bit more binary, whether you fucked it up or not. Like, just little things, like the fact that it completely resets your special weapon charge bar if you get hit. So one little failure, which should translate into losing some armor points, translates into a big failure, which is losing the thing that would make the game easier. So you double fail every time you fail in that mode. And
that's the worst failing of that system for me, is that you get hit and it reduces your ability to actually
respond.
It just removes options from you. I think it's just like, it's a design flaw with that.
Yeah, which actually, it's such an interesting design case, because you compare that to the regular combat system, where getting hit resets you to zero, but it puts you back at the start of the curve. But you're in charge of that curve. Like, the better you play, the faster your combo meter fills up, and the faster you get access to your special moves. It's all quite quick. Whereas, I mean, you charge up the combo meter in the Batmobile by hitting things, but you don't have so much control over when and how you do that. Like, the gun recharges slowly. It's just about not hitting. And the whole system is less of a rewarding feedback loop, and getting hit means far more.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that, yeah, and I think that prompts people to tilt, and ultimately that puts them off the game. And it's probably the reason, like, because I don't think it's terrible, but I think there's a reason why the response has been so bad. I think it's because it's somehow psychologically in this weird place where failing somehow prompts that really negative feedback loop.
It also demands a lot of just rote, boring action from you. Those sequences are long, and they require you to... It's just, you see a line, you have to press X and sideways to get out of the line, and you do that task 100 times in about 10 minutes. And it's just a very long, boring task to have to repeat. And it's kind of, just, again, it's about maintaining that efficiency, but in quite just a visually boring way, in a way it's just not fun to interact with. That makes no sense in the context.
To sort of defend the game against, you know, Tom F. saying on the last podcast that he has a problem with the, you know, the piling on of additional goon types for the regular melee that all have their own counter. The defense to that is actually it keeps it varied in a way that the regular tank combat isn't, because the solution to tank combat is ultimately there are different enemy types, but there's one solution, which is shoot tank with gun. And whereas the different enemy types make you think and make you feel rewarded, like the environmental takedowns that are really cool, add things you can do, right? Like the whole, or when you're fighting with an ally and that kind of thing. So it's constantly variants that mean that you fuck up. It's like, well, I fucked up this one because I'd never fought two big guys before, or, you know, or I didn't make advantage of the fact that I can hit that man with a lamp.
They also allow, like, the combo takedown, fear takedown stuff, and the dual fighting stuff allows them to create scenarios that they otherwise couldn't. So they can actually do a practice section that's much larger with much more people when you have the ability to take out four or five people in one go. They're allowed to do that now, and they could never do that in City because it would just be annoying and just laborious to do it all. And, you know, likewise with the co-op combat, it allows them to do huge combat scenarios that they could never do in City because it would just be annoying and frustrating to go through that combat as one person. So that, like, it unlocks new design options for them in terms of their environments and the levels they're building, whereas the tank stuff has none of that. Like, that, as you say, that never changes. And they throw more and more at you, and there are more and more mandatory battles that are just bigger and bigger, and they just get more and more tedious as you go on, which is dreadful. I just wish that there was a power-up that let me just scan them all, beam them into the back computer, and then the Batwing just sweeps overhead and just nukes them all.
Yeah.
Job done. Get on with it. That was a cool Batman thing I just did. Illuminates an entirely... all the worst section of the game is just removed. this game is immediately better by, like, 5-odd points.
Yeah.
I guess. On the arbitrary stupid scoring scale.
Shh. It's a secret.
Speaking of vehicles in games, the Blast of Times writes via Twitter, Rocket League is basically FIFA with cars. What other games would be improved if the player character was a car? Jamie.
Dearester. Yeah. You're always in first gear. You can never exit first gear, but, you know, slowly drifting through narrative plot points.
Getting to the revelation. Dearest the Tokyo Drift.
Yep, that's one.
Yeah, God. Gone home now.
Tomb Raider, a car in pain, just falling.
Yeah.
Constantly down cliffs. Yeah.
A car wondering if it can, a car mournfully killing a deer. A car discovering its inner strength. A car discovering that it is a bit like its dad. let me think.
Wasn't there a follow-up to that on Twitter? Some kind of...
No, that I have written down here.
It's lost to time.
Let me think. XCOM. No. We've just had one squad mate who was just in a car. So you could pick the others up and... leave. You're good. Rather than waiting for him.
If just one of your Sims could be turned into a car and you just had to deal with that interpersonal relationship.
Like a Kafka kind of stuff.
Yeah. Metamorphosis. Kafka.
The Capcom update for this.
I'm trying to maintain a relationship with your wife now that you're metal on a wheel.
Is that enough?
I think that's probably one of suggestions. Robert Young's games already, actually.
Yeah.
Alex Watts writes on Twitter, congratulations on your century. Where do you expect gaming to be in another 100 episodes?
Given that's 2 years away, what predictions do we have for the year 2017?
Gosh, that sounds so futuristic.
The Division will be about to come out.
And Star Citizen will not be. Yeah, things are not going to be that different in 2 years' time. I mean, if you think about what we were talking about when the podcast started, we were talking about Spelunky,
both of which came up multiple times during this pod.
I don't know. There might be a bit more going on. I mean, the advent of... we'll finally see what impact VR has, probably at the end of this year. That'll be interesting to see how that shakes down. And by the time that, you know, another 2 years rolls around, it'll be the end of this console generation, probably. Things will be looking at streaming. I doubt this console generation will just die, but, like, they'll be...
Bear in mind, the last one lasted, like, 8 years.
Yeah, I think this one's going to last for, like, 10.
This one's only just started, that.
This one's going to take...
No, I suppose so.
It's got a decade to run this one. They're not going to want to relaunch a console after that.
No, but what I mean is that they won't get rid of the consoles anyway. They'll just incorporate streaming into them.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
Graham's Clicker Heroes count will be really impressive.
Yep, put a massive DPS in that thing.
Yeah, I hope that Twitch account is still running by then.
Will Half-Life 3 be out?
No. Left 4 Dead 3, maybe.
I'd love to see Left 4 Dead 3.
VR stuff as well.
Of course, we'll all be dead by then, so.
That's true.
Yeah, really. It won't matter.
Well, you guys will be dead. I'll be trundling around the post-apocalyptic Somerset landscape, raking in bins, looking for backpacks.
As a car.
Punching trees and screaming.
As a car. Storing.
What does a car scream sound like?
Watch the film Cars. There's a
watch the documentary Cars.
The film Cars has a horrifying outtake, and the reason they took it out is because they deliberately made the analogy between cars and humans too convincing, to the extent they actually discover a salvage yard where essentially a car has had its engine taken out and is dead, and has therefore had its brain removed, and it was considered too horrifying for children. So like the way they reacted to it, it was like a horror section they put in there. I believe they took out the film.
Cars does feel also a little bit like a post-apocalyptic film, because it's just a world in which most of the buildings are built as if by humans, but now are inhabited only by sentient cars.
Are we saying it's full map, like, but with cars?
It's
deliberately hints that, I think. I think that's actually an intentional kind of notion, yeah. That actually the cars are the only things alive left in this world.
What happened?
Well,
it's
an excellent question.
Is it cars kill everybody? Is it like, is it like Skynet? Question mark?
Don't know. I'll have to watch it again.
I've never seen that film, so... I guess that's my failing.
Those are all the questions we have?
That's all the time for questions that we have.
Well, in that case, it is also all the time that we have for this podcast. If you'd like to send us more questions, please do so by sending them to questions@christiancrowbar.com, or you can post on our forum, which is at christiancrowbar.com/forum, or you can give us money at our Patreon account, which will be linked in the show notes, because I can't remember what the URL will be offhand. Or you can send us questions individually. I'm Marsh Davis. I'm also Marsh Davis on Twitter. That's with a DAVIES.
I am at Gonnas on Twitter, GONNAS.
I'm at C Thurston on Twitter, CTHURSTEN.
I am at PCG Ludo, which is LUDO.
Did we forget to say our own, the collective Twitter?
At Creighton Grubber.
Yeah.
We did.
Yes.
Well, I did, really. I'll take that one. Take that one for the team. Sorry, guys. Anyway.
I will forgive you.
Support us on Patreon, everybody!
Oh, boy.